Today's Teisho will be on case 37 in the Blue Rock Collection. Aikikan Roku, case 37. Banzan's Three Worlds, No Dharma. Engo's Introduction. The spirit which moves like lightning, you fail to follow. When the bolt descends from the blue, you have no time to cover your ears. The scarlet banner flutters over the master's head. The two-edged sword is brandished behind the student's neck. Unless your eyes are sharp and your hands move quickly, how can you cope with the situation? One will lower his head and ponder, following the delusive ways of thought. Don't you know that countless skulls are haunted by ghosts? I want to ask you, without falling into the delusive way of thinking, and without halting irresolutely, how can you respond to the teacher's words? See the following. Main subject. Banzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds there is no dharma. Where could you find the mind? Secho's verse. Three worlds, no dharma. Where could you find the mind? White clouds crown the heavens. The streams draw music from the harp, tunes and harmonies which none can understand. The night's rain has brought the autumn waters deep. Of course, the purest teaching has already been delivered this morning by a robin outside this building. We have been sitting in a dark room for hours and watching the breath, calling Mu, working with our koans. Maybe this morning, you know, you're tired. Maybe your legs are hurting you. Maybe your mind's very busy. And so you're sitting trying to focus on your breath, sitting trying to focus on Mu, sitting trying to be with your koan, and it's a struggle. Back hurts, tired, maybe hungry. The minutes go by. Maybe they go by like hours. I don't know. So then finally the bell rings and we get up and we have to go to the bathroom. And then we walk outside and that sound of that robin, you know, it's so beautiful. So beautiful. Why is that so? Why is that so? We walk down a little ways and under the linden trees, beautiful linden trees, the sunlight coming through the linden trees on the ground, shadow here, light here, so beautiful. Why is that? You know, on your way to the car in the morning, you must hear a million birds that maybe paying no attention. That robin out there, that song, it can pierce right through your whole body, yeah? Just pierces you right through. It doesn't always do that, you know, on the way to the car, on your way to your class, on your way to the job, you know, this bird singing, hardly pay attention. You know, shadows and light, who doesn't see that all day? But somehow, you know, this morning, after a morning of sitting, we go out and the shadows and light, it's just unspeakably beautiful, unspeakably alive. And how is that possible? How is that possible? Why does that happen? It's so wonderful, but why does that happen? You know, I'm so glad that everybody came here this morning. It's wonderful to see you all. And, you know, I love these Saturday sits. As you know, I like to sit through the first period of meditation and not go to the bathroom because I don't want to interrupt my concentration. And so at the end of an hour and a half of sitting, I, you know, stay in deep mushin, deep shunyata, so that my legs don't begin to bother me or I don't begin to feel tired. And, you know, I know that what I should do is just stay in deep shunyata, deep mushin. But I can't help but sort of peek as people come into the room, you know. So I sort of squinch my eyes and I look to see who's coming. It's like, oh, I'm so glad she's here. I'm so glad she's here. I'm so glad he came. And it's seeing you arrive, sit down in the cushion, if I can make out who you are in the darkness, it's like hearing that robin. It's like seeing my true self face to face. So beautiful. So thank you for coming this morning. Thank you for taking such good care of my true self. I will do my best to take good care of your true self. Okay. So, main subject. Bonzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds there is no Dharma. One question is, why does he say three worlds? Why not just no Dharma? And what does he mean? If there's three worlds, what does it mean to say no Dharma? Many of you know that I work here at Rutgers, and I even, unlike a lot of faculty, I have a job that keeps me in my office over the summer. And so I was in my office the other day, and a student came in to see me. And this student was somebody who had heard about our meditation group here on campus. And he wanted to talk with me. So he came in and sat down and chatted with me and talked very candidly about his life a little bit. And he had heard about our Zen group and vaguely wanted to know about Zen. Maybe Zen could help him. He was a very nice young man, and I was very eager to chat with him. And he basically said that he had had some trouble with depression, which is, as you know, tremendously commonplace. Probably half the population of the United States has problems with has bouts of depression. And especially, I think, young people have bouts of depression. So this young person had heard about our group, and he came in to see me for the first time in my office. And he just said, you know, I've had these bouts of depression over the years, and I just don't know how to deal with it. I thought maybe Zen could help. And I said, well, you know, what is it like when you feel depressed? Because I have to tell you the truth, I've been doing Zen for about 30 years, and I swear to you that if you do this meditation for much less time than that, you will never be depressed again. I swear to you. But I certainly remember being depressed, you know. I can remember being in college and just having a hard time getting up every morning and getting to class. So I sort of remember that pain and that that feeling, that sort of gnawing feeling. So I said, you know, what is this like? You know, what form does this take? And he said, well, you know, I just have this sense of emptiness. You know, everything just seems so empty. And no matter, you know, what I do, if I go to class, it just seems empty. You know, I try to have a good time. I go out with my friends, and I'm sitting in the middle of a party, and everybody seems to be having a great time. And I just feel that it's all pointless and empty. And he went on in that way a little bit. And as he was going on, he was sad, but I was feeling like happier and happier. And I got very excited, you know. And I said, young man, you've come to the right place. Because, you know, this is a wonderful thing. This is just a wonderful thing. Yeah. And I kept trying to tell him that. He didn't seem necessarily to appreciate what I was saying. Because he maybe didn't feel so wonderful right then and there. And I guess we can all remember being 17 and having that sense of the utter, utter pointlessness of it all, right? But I was so excited because I said to him, you know, this is a real blessing. This is like wonderful karma. You know, what luck you have to be haunted by this sense of emptiness. You know, everybody has this sense of emptiness, I think. And, you know, various people respond to it in different ways. I think it's haunting us all the time. You know, there's this feeling of emptiness. And it's an interesting feeling. I mean, we can all remember moments in our lives when, you know, we began to encounter that emptiness. And I think it happens in little parcels, little packets, little events. And then it builds and it builds. And pretty soon we begin to see it everywhere. You know, we try not to see it, but pretty soon we begin to see it everywhere. I mean, you know, my mother told me that there was a Santa Claus, you know. And I have to tell you the truth, I loved the Santa Claus aspect of Christmas. You know, I just loved it. My mother would take me, we used to live in Baltimore at that time when I was a little kid. My father was stationed at the Fort Holabird, a naval station. It may not exist anymore in Baltimore. But my mother used to take me to Hoshel Cohn's department store, which was then the biggest department store in Baltimore. And there was a Santa Claus. I have pictures of the Santa Claus that she took me to see, and he was so good. I mean, he looked like Santa Claus. He was amazing. I mean, he looked a million years old, and he was, you know, chubby. And he had a white beard, and it didn't look phony. You couldn't see the elastic, you know. He must have put it on with, spirit gum, because it looked so real. And I remember as a child just being awed in the presence of this ancient being. And I think Santa Claus resonates with people because it's this ancient being, you know. It's like running into Lao Tzu. It's this ancient being who comes from the North Pole, you know. What, that is so cool. So mysterious. He ancient, like the spirit of nature almost, like the spirit of the North Pole. And he's going to, you know, the presents hardly matter, although, you know, those are good. But I remember just being so awed by this mysterious being. And, you know, you would have to sit on his lap and tell him what you wanted for Christmas. And it was just an awesome experience for me, like really like a religious experience. And you know, I really loved this experience. I loved the whole idea of this mysterious being with his sleigh and so on. And then, you know, when I was about, when I went off to college, my mother told me there was no Santa Claus. Well, it wasn't that late. But it was late. I was probably around 10 or something like that. And everybody else in my school, I think, knew, you know, in my grade knew there was no Santa Claus, but I just hung on to that for so long. In fact, my little brother told me there was no Santa Claus. And I just didn't, and I went to my mother and I said, Mom, you know, I knew it. You know, it's like one of those things, you know, in your intimate heart, you want to believe so much in Santa Claus. And I said, Mom, you know, there is no Santa Claus, is there? My mother is a tremendously sweet person. And she had enjoyed so much my pleasure in all of this. And she said, no, you know, there is no Santa Claus, but there's a Santa Claus in your heart. And I kind of felt like, well, that's, you know, that's not exactly what I thought. You know, I was a little bit disappointed. The Santa Claus in my heart, okay, that's okay. But I really wanted a Santa Claus who lived in the North Pole. So, you know, that was like little taste of emptiness, right? You know, you have this belief which is deeply moving, and connects with something very primal. And then something happens to sort of like snap you out of the dream. And when that happens, you feel so barren, you know, feel so lifeless, or just like something has been taken away from you that was very precious. And I think this happens to people over and over again. It's like watching a movie and starting to believe the movie, and then at some point the camera breaks and you're left staring at the blank screen. You know, it's a little bit unnerving. You know, and I think this happens to us again and again. You know, when we're little kids, we imagine our parents perhaps as being very wise and capable. You know, and then you get older and you see maybe you see your father or your mother vulnerable and maybe helpless, and it's very little frightening, but there's also this undercurrent of like a erosion of trust or it's like, well, what is real then? You know? And I think this builds up in life over time. It's like again and again we begin to see how artificial some of this is, and we want so much to believe in it, you know, because we remember what it meant when we were young. But we begin to see it, the artifice of it all, the sort of not real quality. And I think as you get older, there's like this desperate attempt to find some, you know, people say, I'm trying to find something to believe in. You know, I've got to find, I need some, and people will say, I believe in this because I need something to believe in. And I think adulthood involves like this desperate search for some, quote unquote, something to believe in. And people latch on to all kinds of things. You know, some of them are good and some of them are bad. You know, so I think that in the period of, you know, Nazi Germany, for example, this sense of emptiness was very powerful. And I think one of the reasons Hitler was able to be so successful was that he was able to give people something, people who were profoundly disillusioned, you know, had seen their ideals, the curtain had been opened again and again, and they saw behind the curtain so many times. And then Hitler came along, I think, and said, look, I've got something that's true and real, and people just jumped on me. But, you know, I don't think everybody who says that is a Hitler. You know, I think that some people respond to that emptiness by becoming tremendously creative and productive. You know, they throw themselves. I have a friend of mine who has written so many books, and he has struggled all his life with a drinking problem. I mean, when I first met him, he was in the throes of real alcoholism. And he was a very distinguished scholar, but, you know, had real, you know, he would come to meetings and his face would be flushed. And, you know, I wasn't the person who confronted him, but somebody must have. And I know that he's been, he's been working with this problem and no longer drinks. He has a very strict regimen, in fact, trying to control his emptiness sickness. He writes book after book. That's how he deals with this gnawing sense of emptiness, book after book after book. And I think some people, you know, go to Thailand and help people who have been tsunami victims, that kind of thing. This is another way people respond to this gnawing sense of emptiness. But for most people, I think it still remains something frightening, and it's like at the back of your life there's this thing, and it's so scary, so frightening. But, you know, it's really not what people think. It's really not so terrible. Not at all. You know, my personal feeling is that one of the things that sets Buddhism apart from its origins in India is this special engagement with emptiness, with what we in Zen call mu-shin, shunyata. And after Lord Buddha, at his Daikensho, he talked about emptiness. But people didn't necessarily understand him, even Buddhist practitioners. And about 1,000 years later, Nagarjuna renewed attention to this very important aspect of reality, but still very difficult for people to come to terms with. But in China, you know, people from the beginning, I think, have had a different attitude towards this this element of life. A different attitude, and it's one of the reasons I think Zen took such deep roots in China. You know, the other day I got a new translation of Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching by Red Pine is his pen name. He's a former Chan monk who is now a lay person living in Port Townsend, Washington. He does these wonderful translations. But this is the 11th verse of Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. 30 spokes converge on a hub, on a wheel. 30 spokes converge on a hub, but it's the emptiness that makes a wheel work. Pots are fashioned from clay, but it's the hollow that makes the pot work. Windows and doors are carved for a house, but it's the spaces that make the house work. Existence makes something useful, but non-existence makes it work. I think that's beautiful. You know, that ancient book, I think, is one of the reasons the Chinese were able to understand the Dharma so quickly. This a very positive view of emptiness. You know, most people don't like emptiness in our culture. And when they come in to do Zen practice, they're probably looking for something very different. I know that I was. You know, I wanted mystical experiences. I wanted, like, visions, particularly visions. You know, I had read a lot about comparative religion when I was an undergraduate. And I really loved this idea of vision quests. You know, the Plains Indians used to go off on a vision quest, and they would fast, and sometimes they would inflict small injuries on themselves so that they could have a vision. And, you know, a person might fast for days and days out in the solitary wilderness and might peel away pieces of his skin, not part of what I wanted to do, but... you know, have a vision, and then, you know, might see a buffalo, and you know, realize this is my destiny, is to hunt buffalo or something. And that was so appealing to me. So, you know, when I started doing Zen, I really wanted to have these visions, and I would sometimes talk to my teacher Genki Roshi about my dreams. I'd come in and say, Genki Roshi, I had a dream. He'd just cut me off. It's like, I had this dream, though, this time. I think this was like a special dream, you know. And I'd say, I saw the Buddha. You know, he was just above me on my left shoulder, you know. Or my cat. I saw my cat, and he went through a hole in the wall, and it was dark, you know. And Genki would just, you know, conclude the interview. I couldn't figure out what he wanted. And I would go back and sit on the cushion, and I had a lot of thoughts, and mostly thoughts for a long time, a lot of pain in my legs. And every once in a while, I didn't note. It took me years. It took me about 5 years to begin to notice that every once in a while, my mind was just a little bit blank. It's like you sit on the cushion, and you're supposed to watch your breath, and your mind is buzzing with thoughts, and it's like thought, 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 and then you see the breath for a few seconds, and it's thought, 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 and then you see the breath, thought, 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 breath. And it took me forever to realize that if you watch the breath, if you can just watch the breath, you know, the breath takes you out, out, out. And Genki Roshi kept saying, you know, Genki was a Zen master, so he had like these mysterious ways of saying things. He'd say, where does the breath with eyes go? Right? And so I would do the worst thing. I'd go back and think, breath with eyes, what could that mean? Right? And I'd try to interpret it. The breath with eyes must be this. You know, and then I'd come back and say, the breath with eyes is this. Ding. So, you know, I'd watch the breath, think, memory, whatever, you know. I'm self-loathing because I'm not getting anywhere with my koan, you know. And then, you know, just it began to happen that once in a while I would just enter this thoughtless state, like this blank state, where my mind would just be blank. And it took me 5 years to notice it, because every time that would happen, I would think, oh, this is not what I, you know, this is junk. Get this out of the way. And I also think that I had anxiety about it. I mean, I think that humans have an instinctual anxiety. At least, I take that back. I think Western people have an instinct, sort of a culturally created anxiety that feels instinctive about this emptiness, you know. And I think I would just back away from it. But, you know, the strange thing was it would come more and more. And the other strange thing was that I would feel better and better. You know, I would sit on the cushion and try to answer my koan, so-called, and I would watch the breath, and every once in a while my mind would just enter this blank state, which I would back out of very quickly. And then it would come back, and then it would come back. And I began to feel much better. You know, much better, much happier, more connected to things. It was wonderful. And it took me just the longest time. I guess culturally we're just afraid of this. You know, nobody wants to face that emptiness. But that emptiness is the most wonderful thing in the world. The Chinese understood this. See, Lao Tzu understood this. You know, this emptiness is like the door into enlightenment. This is like the fountain of everything. You know, everything comes out of this emptiness. It's just wonderful. But, you know, it takes a long time to get comfortable with this. I had to work on the breath perception koan for about 5 years. And as you probably know, after you do the breath perception koan, you do the mu koan, which is focusing on that emptiness. So, you know, the idea is that basically, initially, you start watching the breath, and you're struggling with thoughts, and struggling with pain in your legs, and so on. And as your body, mind, and heart are purified by this practice, another way to put it is are refined or made more sensitive and receptive by this practice, you begin to notice that there are these empty moments in consciousness itself. We think of consciousness as a continuous stream. We can say stream of consciousness, for example. If you could read, not that I've been able to, I must confess I teach English, but I've never finished Ulysses. Don't tell anybody in my department that. But I can't get through it. You know, it's just murder. And it used to just be boring. But now I also think it's not accurate, you know, because consciousness isn't like that. You know, what James Joyce should have is some thoughts, and then there should be some thoughts, and Leopold Bloom went to the bar and did this and this and this and thought this, and then it should be like a big black box for half a page, and then some thoughts, and then maybe a little black box for half, you know, for a third of the page, and then some thoughts, and pretty soon it should be like thought black, thought black, thought black, thought like that. You know, because actually, if you meditate long enough, consciousness is really like that. It's just like that. You know, when I was a kid, we at one point in my life, I lived on a military base in Virginia, Naval Weapons Station. And we were all these kids trapped in the boondocks with nothing to do. We were the sons and daughters of naval people. So they had a little theater that they had hooked up for us on Saturday. We could go for like a dime and see a movie. And it was made with like, you know, it was like some kind of a lecture hall for the officers and enlisted men. And they fixed it up like a theater for us. It was very kind of them. And they had this old projector, and we would get these movies, whatever they could get, you know, really things that kids shouldn't see, like Zorba the Greek and things like that, and which I understood none of, as a matter of fact, when I saw it. And but they had, I remember, you know, this thing would break down periodically. So, you know, you'd be in the middle of a movie, and either the film would just break because they had an old copy, or the speed would get off, and it would begin to slow down, and so you'd begin to see like the frames flashing. You know, a movie is not a continuous stream of images. It's an image, and another image, and another image. But the mind deletes the spaces between the images. When the timing on the projector is off, you begin to notice it's image, 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 and there are these spaces, so actually luminous little spaces between the images, right? And it's sort of an unnerving feeling. Well, if you meditate long enough, you will begin to notice that indeed that is actually how consciousness is. It's like a form, blank, form, blank, form, blank. Very, very fast. But if you meditate long enough, consciousness becomes extremely acute, extremely receptive, and very, very fast. And you can notice these spaces. And it's quite stunning when you begin to notice this. So, you know, for some reason, it just happens to people that they encounter this blankness. And, you know, our culture says this is a terrible thing and you should be afraid of it. But it's actually quite natural and normal. It's really part of perception itself. And it's a very big part of life, very big part of reality. See? And so there's really nothing wrong with you if you feel this sense of emptiness. In fact, if you feel it, you know, you should really be excited. You know, this feeling like it's your birthday and you go home and you think, I know that everybody's preparing a party for me. Right? Where are the presents? You know, you look in the closet, no presents. You know, you look in the refrigerator, where are the treats? You know, where's the cake? These devils, you know. This is going to be wonderful, right? You know, so 10 o'clock, no party. You know, 11 o'clock, no party. Finally, everybody turns in, and you realize, oh, no birthday party. Poor me. You know, you sit in your bed and think, well, I feel so empty. Well, don't let that go. Well, don't let that go. See, those moments in life, which can be so disappointing, you know, are really like wonderful moments. Where it's like when you didn't get your grant, you know, when they rejected your article, when your girlfriend dumps you, yeah, and it hurts so much, right? And there's that emptiness there. But this is like, that's, it's just, the, it feels bad and it feels painful because our senses are so crude. You know, if you have an experience like that and you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath and you enter Mushin, you feel that pain, whatever caused you that pain is just a, like karmic residue. It hurts and it hurts and it hurts and it hurts. After a while it goes away, you know, and then you just feel this wonderful sense of being alive, being alive. You know, life energy pouring through your body. Life energy pouring through your body. And this is what happens to people who come to Sesshin. We have our wonderful Sesshin and people sit on the cushion and call Mu. Our practice is to focus the mind on the word Mu. So you breathe out and you say Mu, which means nothing, or nothingness, emptiness. And you know, then you do it again and again, and you do that for 10 hours a day. Right? And at some point, you begin to have this feeling like you're, like there's no Santa Claus, you know, or like there's not going to be a birthday party for you today, you know, and there's no presents in the closet, and, you know, there's no check in the mail, and it's not pleasant, you know, but you just keep going, you keep going, pretty soon you just, where is this energy coming, this wonderful energy? You know, my heart is, I thought my heart was breaking because I'm so disappointed. But now I know my heart is breaking because I love this life so much. See, I love, oh my God. You know, this is, now I understand. So we say, I am not the robin in the tree. You know, that's a living in form. You know, if your reality is made up of conclusions reached by paying attention to the moments where your consciousness is filled with something, get a very false image. Because, you know, I and the bird are not connected on the level of form. See, now, I'm not the same as the bird on the level of form. And so it seems very different because the connecting principle is that heartbreaking emptiness, yeah? And when you put that in the picture, everything connects. It's the most amazing, it's like, this is why everything seems fractured and fragmented, right? Can't bring them together. You know, no theory is going to bring them together. No, you know, artists try to make it all coherent, all alive. But it's hopeless, wonderful and hopeless. Because the connector isn't visible in the realm of form. Connector is this mushin, is this shunyata. You know, so we get up, we come to Saturday sit, and sit down on the cushion, and our back aches, and we're hungry, and we're tired, and you think, why did I come here? You know? And you sit and you watch your breath and your mind is buzzing like a beehive, and every once in a while, just blank, blank, blank. What's that all about? Blank, blank. Then you get up and you walk outside and you hear that robin and you think, my God, it's coming right out of my own body. You know, I feel like even putting it in words is already too diminish it. It's so alive. It's that the connection is not on the level of form. The connection is the mushin. That's like the glue that holds the universe together. When we spend a little time with mushin, everything seems to connect. Everything seems so alive, right? So beautiful. I was just reading this wonderful encounter between Master Yunmen, Master Cloudgate, and one of his students. It goes like this. Someone asked Master Cloudgate, It is said that one should not leave home to become a monk without one's parents' consent. How then should we leave home? So this is somebody who's like trapped in the realm of thought, in the realm of idea. And the master says, shallow. So he says to the young man, I'm trying to decide how I should practice Zen. Should I obey my parents or should I disobey my parents? Because if I'm going to obey my parents, I'll stop doing Zen. And if I do Zen, I'll displease my parents, but I'll please myself. What should I do? Yunnan says, shallow. And then the monk says, I don't understand. Yunnan says, deep. Deep. Don't you? I love that. Deep. So, you know, just a pointer. You know, sometimes when you're sitting on the cushion, you feel really happy and wonderful, and that's a great feeling. But sometimes you might feel like your heart is breaking, or like you're going to cry. You know, and that's where I think sometimes that happens. Sometimes where we're at this edge, where we're entering that emptiness, and it feels like a loss, right? Feels like, you know, you enter that emptiness and it feels like Christmas morning and there's no presents under the tree, you know, no Santa Claus, etc., etc. And it's like my heart is breaking. That's the most important place sometimes that you can be in your practice. You might sometimes feel a little weepy, you know, when you're sitting or after you're sitting. It's like my heart is breaking. You know, but don't let that frighten you. Don't let that put you off, because it's like, just let it break. Let it break. You're going to slide right into it. You're going to slide right into it. You know, and there won't be any vision of floating bodhisattvas. Won't be any. You know, when the little mind looks at the big mind, all it ever sees is darkness. Yeah? Because the little mind's too small to see it. So you have to feel your way with big mind. And then all, you know, feel like your heart is breaking. Heart is breaking, heart is breaking, and then heart is so full. Heart is so full. It's unbearable how beautiful this life really is. Yeah? Shunyata and world of form. Or as Banzan says, three worlds. Three worlds, that's the traditional Buddhist understanding, three worlds. World of desire, world of form, world of formlessness. These are three elements, three dimensions of human awareness. Desire, form, formlessness. So three worlds, no dharma. Three worlds, emptiness, emptiness, emptiness. Banzan said to his disciples, in the three worlds there is no dharma. Where could you find the mind? He said, where will you place your mind? Where is the right place to put your mind? This is a wonderful koan. Because it's all your mind. All your mind. When you sit on the cushion, busy thoughts, it's your mind. My mind. Your life. My life. Enter thoughtless, blank state. Your life. My life. And go out, hear the beautiful bird. All of this is one life, right? One mind. Just beautiful. So I want to thank you for coming here and taking such good care of my true self. And I promise to take with my last breath and all my strength to take care of your true self.